On this week's 51%, just more than 1 year after the kidnapping of Nigerian schoolgirls, we'll hear from Amnesty International on militant group Boko Haram.
The information that we've been getting from some of those people that have been able to escape is that they've been subjected to torture, some have been raped.
Vermont takes action to close the pay gap, and a trio of stories for Mother's Day. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. In April 2014, Islamist militant group Boko Haram kidnapped more than 200 schoolgirls. The plight of the Chibok girls gained global attention, but Amnesty International says there are many more victims. DW's Mark Caldwell produced the following piece 1 year to the day of the kidnappings. He spoke with Amnesty researcher Daniel Eyre.
Exactly a year ago, on April 14th, 2014, the Islamist militant group Boko Haram kidnapped more than 200 schoolgirls from a boarding school in northeastern Nigeria. The plight of the Chibok girls gained global attention with the help of the Bring Back Our Girls campaign. But according to the rights group Amnesty International, the missing girls are only a small fraction of Boko Haram's kidnapped victims. Amnesty says as many as 2,000 women and girls have been abducted since the start of 2014. I asked Amnesty researcher Daniel Eyre what had happened to them.
The information that we've been getting from some of those people that have been able to escape is that they've been subjected to torture, some have been raped. We've found that some have been forced to marry Boko Haram members, and also some of them have been trained as fighters. We actually spoke with a 19-year-old woman who'd been abducted back in September of 2014, and she was taken to a Boko Haram camp, held there for 3 months, during which time she was repeatedly raped, on one occasion by 6 men, and was also trained to shoot weapons and also how to use bombs. She told me that she'd been taken on an operation with other Boko Haram fighters to her own village. So these are the kind of horrific stories that are coming from just some of those people that have been able to escape from Boko Haram control.
Why is it that Boko Haram is able to operate with impunity?
Well, in the second half of 2014, Boko Haram began to take control of some of the major towns and cities in northeast Nigeria. And what they did was to first of all attack the military barracks, force the soldiers out, and steal the arms and ammunition that they had there. So through a pattern of these attacks, they were able to get stronger and stronger, taking these weapons and using them to attack new locations. We actually found that since 2014, Boko Haram has killed more than 5,500 civilians in such attacks. So over the last 15 months, Boko Haram really did grow in strength. It's only since mid-February that the Nigerian military, with support from other countries, has been able to start pushing Boko Haram out of major towns. However, that doesn't necessarily mean an end to the conflict. Even during that time, Boko Haram has still been attacking civilians. I spoke with someone just last week whose village was attacked. 27 men were rounded up and executed in that attack. So the conflict is still very much ongoing.
But is this military offensive weakening Boko Haram? Is it preventing it from carrying out the abductions we've been talking about?
Unfortunately, it's still too early to tell. As I said last week, I spoke with someone last week whose village had been attacked on the 27th of March. So that's really, you know, very, very recent. But we've also seen Boko Haram killing civilians and destroying towns as they've been pushed out of them by the military. Just in Bama, for example, one town in the northeast, satellite images show that Boko Haram destroyed around 5,900 buildings just before they fled. They set fire to the houses, and you know, people died in those fires. So Boko Haram's still very deadly.
That was Mark Caldwell conducting the interview with Amnesty International researcher Daniel Eyre for Deutsche Welle. April 14th in the United States met an entirely different significance. It was National Equal Pay Day. Meanwhile, the Paycheck Fairness Act in Congress has not been passed. In Vermont, the governor's administration recently announced the creation of an initiative aimed at closing the wage gap between men and women in Vermont. 51%'s Pat Bradley reports.
According to the U.S. Department of Labor, women are paid 78 cents for every dollar a man earns nationally. Females fare a bit better in Vermont, earning 83 cents for every dollar a man is paid. In an effort to close the wage gap, Governor Peter Shumlin and the Vermont Commission on Women have launched the Vermont Equal Pay Compact. Commission Executive Director Carrie Brown says it's based on work being done in Massachusetts.
We were inspired by a group in Boston called the Boston Women's Workforce Council that's doing something similar. And we thought that having a voluntary compact that employers could sign on to saying what steps they're going to take to help close the wage gap would be a great complement to legislation and education and other kinds of policy change that could help us all work together to make sure we get rid of this wage gap.
Women Business Owners Network Vice President Mary Claire Carroll owns Carroll Photos. She calls the Vermont Equal Pay Compact a wonderful idea.
Women and women organizations have been fighting for equal pay since the early 1900s. Most people don't know that. The battle has been going on for quite a while, and since the Equal Pay Act was signed in 1963 by John F. Kennedy, we've made very little progress. And despite legislation, despite years of work to close the gap, it's a slow progress. And what the compact does, it's an education program. And I think it's also about talking about the benefits of equal pay.
The initiative is voluntary. When employers sign the compact, they will be asked, according to Brown, to provide concrete steps that they will take to both learn about the wage gap and address it in their workplace.
They can range from things like providing information about the wage gap to your employees. They could be doing an internal audit to see if you really are paying everybody equally. It can be things like establishing mentoring or leadership development program, or helping women learn negotiation skills, because that's another reason why they sometimes don't get paid as much. It can be doing education programs that are exposing young women and girls to your field, because exposure to different kinds of careers is often a reason why girls don't take the right education to be able to enter the higher paying jobs. So it's really going to depend on what the individual employer is doing already and how they want to expand what they're doing.
Carol says she's been involved in the equal pay issue for a long time and is excited that the Shumlin administration and the Commission on Women have created an initiative to try to close the wage gap.
I've always felt that there's several ways to go about this. One is the legislation piece, and the other part is the education piece, both educating employees and employers about the value of closing the gender gap. Years ago, there was this study done at the national level that looked at all the reasons for the pay gap that people throw out. And after taking away all those factors, they kept coming down to the basic thing that there is still discrimination out there, that there's still employers that feel that a woman doesn't need to get paid the same as a man for doing the same job.
For 51%, I'm Pat Bradley.
So you sign all the papers in the family name. You're sad and you're sorry, but you're not ashamed. A little green, have a happy ending. Just a little green, by the color when the
In recognition of Mother's Day, we offer the next three stories. The first focuses on an unwed mother, the second on a woman who does not want children, and the third on a teen's letter calling for connection with her mom. Jamie is pregnant with nowhere to go. She finds herself at St. Andre Home in Maine, a place for unwed mothers, where she awaits her fourth child, Angel. Chloe Parsinos reports.
A pink camouflage sweatsuit hugs Jamie's frame. She wears a near-perfect match pink eyeshadow, but it doesn't do much to mask the exhaustion in her face. And her camo sweatsuit does nothing to disguise her pregnant stomach. She's 32 weeks along.
There's been a lot that's gone on in my life. I don't know where you want me to start. doesn't matter. Jamie Lynn Martell is my name.
Jamie is 28 years old, but she still has certain childlike qualities that linger. She brought three Jolly Ranchers to our interview, two red, one pink. You can hear the candy in her mouth as she speaks.
I haven't really had a very good upbringing, shall I say, when I was 7 or 8 years old. We became homeless.
Jamie's father was an alcoholic, her mother an addict.
And my parents had signed over their parental rights, and I went into a foster home for a while. I kept causing trouble because I didn't want to be there. I had a lot of anger towards my parents for what they did.
Jamie had her first baby at 22, but not unlike her parents, Jamie had to give her daughter up.
I needed to do what was best for her, and I knew that she was going to be well taken care of.
Jamie went to a homeless shelter, where she met Kurt.
He followed me around like a lost puppy dog, and finally I, you know, gave in and I said, yes, you know, you can take me out to dinner or whatever, and from then on we were always together.
Jamie and Kurt had two kids together, a little boy and a little girl. But as time went on, things started to deteriorate.
He was drinking every day, and then it got to the point where he became very, very violent. With everything going on with him, I was abusing my prescription medication. I didn't realize it was a problem then. I had no idea about addiction and what that was all about.
One day, during a particularly nasty fight, Jamie texted her mother to say it was happening again. Jamie's mother called the police.
And I answered the door, and, are you Jamie Martell? And I said, yes, I am. Is there a problem?
When the police saw the conditions the kids were living in, Child Protective Services got involved. It's hard for Jamie to talk about what happened next.
I don't share my feelings or my emotions with anybody. I keep everything bottled up inside. It just hurts. And I didn't want to sign over my parental rights, but I was in a rock and a hard place. I had nothing else that I could do. I miss them so much. I really do. So I signed over my parental rights, and then I relapsed. I relapsed really, really hard.
Jamie was alone. Her children were gone. Kurt was in and out of the picture, and Jamie sank deeper and deeper into addiction. Then, Jamie found out she was pregnant with her fourth child. DHS came to visit.
And they said to me, they told me that, you know, if we find you an unfit mother and you have this child, we'll take this child too.
And that was it. Jamie snapped. She cut ties with Kurt and checked herself into a detox center.
And then they came here to St. Andre's. And my main goal is, you know, has been to get myself better so that I can take care of this child and then eventually be there for, you know, my other children. Because I want to keep this child.
A boy she's named Angel. The home has Jamie on a tight schedule. She's up every morning at 7:30. Her house chore has to be done before 10. Then she's in intensive outpatient from 10:45 to 2:30, sometimes a group home meeting at 3, house dinner at 5.
You're getting structure, you know, people there to help you out, you know, to make sure that when you go out there in the real world, you have the tools, you have the skills, and you know what you need to do.
But Jamie resents some of the structure at the home, like all the life skills classes she's expected to attend, especially cooking class.
Sometimes I find it annoying because I really am not the type of person to be cooking, but I join the group and try and slap a smile on my face. I'm here. Okay. What are we learning?
Jennifer Rodolfi says that it may seem basic, But most of the women here need to learn to do simple things for themselves.
Like that. So it's going to be, that's going to be like a small dice.
Okay. Okay. Perfect.
It's often a life lesson that I think we take for granted, that that's just something you learn as you grow. But if you don't have a role model and you don't have what we would call a natural support, people in your life, like friends and family, to model that, then you don't get it. And you need it to survive.
But St. Andre Home is a shelter for pregnant women. So how will these women survive in the coming months once they have their babies and they have to leave? It's a point of tension in the home, and it comes up a lot, especially in group home meetings. The women trickle into the living room and slowly lower themselves into the plush red couch. Jamie reaches for the remote and turns off the reality show on TV. Nicole, a staff member, leads the meeting.
No, we're not a homeless shelter. We're a homeless shelter for pregnant women. We have to work on getting you guys on your own.
So the plan is to go back out and get knocked up so you can hang here while you try to find another place. I'm just kidding.
So say you fill out housing application.
Jamie doesn't know where she will land next. St. Andre Home will help Jamie find an apartment and make sure she's connected to the city's social services. But the waiting list for subsidized housing in this county is 4 years long. There's only so much St. Andre Home can do.
I haven't had the easiest time with this one, but it's almost over with, and I can't wait to see them and hold them and be happy hunky-dory.
Jamie has a tough task ahead. She's already lost 3 children because she couldn't care for them, and she knows that this is her chance. But once Angel arrives, Jamie will have to leave St. Andre Home and find a home of her own. And then she and Angel will have to take it from there. For Salt Radio, I'm Chloe Persinos.
Next, Amy Gastelum speaks with Leah Cinquegrano, who says she does not ever want to have a baby.
I grew up with a very attentive mother who was like a career mom. That was her career, was raising her 2 kids. And she feels like it was the best thing she ever did, and she doesn't understand how I can't. I told her I was doing this, actually, and what she said to me was, "Now, Leah, you know me. You know I'm cool, and when I tell you, I swear this is the best thing I ever did with my life. How can you not just believe me and be a little interested in following suit?" And I'm just not.
The primary reason that you don't want to have children, what is that?
Well, there's a number of reasons. But when I really think about my life and its trajectory, I don't see this in the picture. I prefer to cultivate my skills and my talents and ideas rather than procreate. But also, I have a lot of worry. I go to bed very concerned about my own life and well-being and my boyfriend Nick's and my parents and my brother and his kid. And I can't imagine introducing another extension, another human to worry about in that way. It's really, I have an overwhelming fear of someone dying by way of a tragic occurrence. And even myself, I'm really worried about my own mortality.
It sounds like you live with a little bit of fear.
I do. I have fear. I have fear, and I think that that probably has to do with my upbringing. My mother's Catholic.
Okay. Well, how does that relate to fear for you?
I feel like, in a way, I grew up with the fear of God in me about certain things, and that was bestowed upon me by my mother's sort of strict religious upbringing that she had and that she felt was the right ethical way to raise her kids.
So your mom essentially filled you with fear, and then now you're turning around and going, "Mom, I can't have a baby because I'm too afraid."
I don't think I've said that. I don't think she would even think that she would never be able to take she would never take responsibility for that feeling. How about you? Did you plan your pregnancy?
Yeah, I guess I planned it. I mean, I was like, I know I want to have kids and whatever. But children, they're so familiar to me that I don't know. And plus, I really like them. But I respect the fact that you're so, like, conscientious about this and really thinking about it. I mean,
you have to have that desire. You have to initiate that on your own. Plus, it's such a commitment. It not only it takes that desire, but the willingness to commit your whole life and your body and sacrifice so many things for this child. You have to really, really want it. And if you don't, you should not have a child. I have some older women in my life that are that never had children. Nick's aunt is one of them. With Nick, his aunt was a big influence in his desire to become an artist. And she looks great. And she's so tapped into culture. She introduced him to New York. She took him here when he was a kid for the first time. And they have a really special, amazing bond. He talks to her every week, I think. And she's been to visit us more than my parents have been to visit us. So I think that's something that is extremely, that's a very special and unique relationship that I'm looking forward to with Nick's niece as well as my nephew. I'm really excited to be this sort of alternate parent, and the cool, maybe cooler, who knows?
The cool aunt.
The cool aunt and uncle. And I don't think that there's anything wrong with wanting or not wanting to have children. It's just a personal choice, and you should feel okay with saying, babies aren't my thing.
We close this week's show with a letter from a teenage daughter to her mom about love, hope, and Chuck E. Cheese.
I remember driving with you to Chuck E. Cheese, just me and you. Nobody else. I didn't have to share you with Eric, Jesse, Brian, or Megan. I didn't have to shout, shotgun, to claim the front seat. You were mine for the whole night. We talked about anything I wanted, whether it was school and how Miss Murphy was preparing us for our Christmas concert, or your job and how it was so difficult dealing with people you didn't really care for, or even how my name came to be. How you purposely gave me your initials, N-A-M. You made me smile. You made me feel as if I were your favorite child. Going into Chuck E. Cheese and finding a big booth just for me and you. We played the 007 shooting game, and I killed you, and you just laughed. Playing the spider stomping game and stomping the red lights on the floor, and you were telling me, right there, and I still missed them. Hearing the spiders scream and you mocking the spiders screaming. Racing to the ball pit and searching for coins to show you. Soaring through the plastic tubes, waving hi to you from the highest one. You were mine. I knew that. Being with you is the best thing that I will always remember. Spending time with you is all I ever wanted, and you gave that to me, and I am thankful for you. I don't know exactly what happened. We don't talk as much anymore, and we don't hang out. We barely even say hi. I want you to know that I still remember all those great times, when we did have fun together, when we did talk to get to know each other. I just wanted to tell you that I miss you, Mom. I hope you miss me, too. I want you to know that it's not too late, and you haven't lost me.
That was Natalie Marquez for Curie Youth Radio, a writing and radio production class at Curie High School on Chicago's Southwest Side. And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1345.